Alrighty, so here's where we're at right now. We're at the last part of a critique of N.T. Wright's place within the emerging global theology. So this is the fourth of five sections of Doctrine and Division, and we called it polemical theology because that just means having to do with argument, which is not a dirty word. Of course, it's become a dirty word. It means a quarrel now, or some kind of a sinful strife of some kind, when classically the word just meant a flow of reasoning from premises to conclusions. But of course, since we're afraid of our own shadow in the modern world, words like that, of course, take on dirty connotations. So where we're at is we've looked at three different movements that are really sort of a hurricane swirling around, believing really the same thing: the new perspectives on Paul, the federal vision, and then that emerging or emergent church, which at first glance may have or seem to you to have nothing to do with each other. Well, we do see some common threads, and these are not, as I said, this is not a guilt by association argument. These are a group of would-be evangelicals, at least claiming for the title, and are given that title by evangelical, traditional evangelical publishing houses and other institutions, who blame a lot of the same things and see a lot of the same solutions. And so that at that point, it stops becoming a guilt by association argument. It becomes more difficult to dismiss it as a guilt by association argument. And you have to deal with the questions: why do they come to these same conclusions? Why are they blaming some of these same things? And of course, the main thing that they're seeking to find a scapegoat for is individualism in the modern church. And two things in particular, well, I'd say one thing in general, another thing in particular, as the problem. One is the old Western idea of insight, an individual soul looking outside of himself at truth. That is now called Gnostic. And that issue, the view of the soul that comes from that, that the mind is superior in some way to the body, that is now part of Gnostic dualism. Because of that arrogant mistake that created everything Western, i.e. everything evil in the world, because of that mistake, the particular doctrine of justification by faith alone, and really all the doctrines of grace, but this at the center, becomes the culprit in these movements. So these are people who have set themselves, like it or not, as enemies of the gospel and enemies of the Christian worldview. Now, the federal vision does that in a more modified form than the new perspectives do and the emergent church does. But nevertheless, they go down the same road at different rates. Well, another important distinction or an implication of making everything fit your system, which is what N.T. Wright does, is that it really does change everything. It's difficult to hear from some of our favorite teachers that Wright is not suggesting a different gospel simply because such a conclusion would imply that he is personally under the anathema of Galatians 1, 8, and 9. Love John Piper, but some statements of his along those lines have made that suggestion. That's a humongous and devastating category mistake by him. The idea that if we say N.T. Wright is preaching a different gospel to some extent, that therefore we have to, that puts him in the category of the anathema that Paul talked about in Galatians 1. Well, reread or revisit the first few chapters of this book or the first few lectures from last year and see why that inference is not necessarily necessary. On the other hand, Wright has explicitly set forth an alternative gospel and denounced the old one as a privatized tragedy, whether or not Wright even realizes it. So let's listen to Wright's own words on the matter. And both of these quotes are from what St. Paul really said. So if somebody says, are you saying that Wright preaches a different gospel at least than you do?
I can do you one better. Let's start with this. Forget about me for a second. I want to show you that N.T. Wright thinks he's preaching a different gospel than me. Clearly, he thinks his is the biblical one. I get that. But let's at least start with this. Quote, "If you take the old route of putting justification in its traditional meaning at the center of your theology, you will always be in danger of sustaining some sort of individualism." Remember the blame over there. "This wasn't so much a problem in Augustine's or even in Luther's day, when society was much more bound together than it is now. But both in Enlightenment modernism and in contemporary postmodernism, individualism has been all the rage. Tragically," Wright says, "some would-be presentations of," quote, "the gospel," it's in quotes in his paragraph, "some would-be presentations of the gospel have actually bought into this by implying that one is justified or saved first and foremost as an individual." Yes, I will plead guilty to that. But Wright is saying that that's a tragedy. That is a would-be presentation of the gospel, i.e., at the very least, a different gospel than the one Wright thinks is right. Here's another quote from what St. Paul really said a couple pages later. "The point is this. The covenant between God and Israel was always designed to be God's means of saving the whole world. It was never supposed to be the means whereby God would have a private little group of people who would be saved while the rest of the world went to hell." In parentheses, whatever you might mean by that. End quote. As if only we mean something by it, and Jesus apparently didn't mean anything by it. Now, one does not need to play God in order to be discerning. To borrow a phrase from our current president, placing someone under the divine anathema is a little above my pay grade. Wright is saying that we preach a different gospel. Now, whether he's correct or not, in his own mind, he is preaching a different gospel than we are. In his mind, he is preaching a different gospel than Piper is. His words, not our words. A simple review of the basic laws of logic might be helpful as an anecdote for the Reformed theologian right now. But I will choose instead a simple example from that very book of Galatians that I think will be even more helpful. Paul opposed Peter to his face. Why did he do that? Well, in the second chapter, Paul uses a series of phrases to describe his mindset and motives for going to Jerusalem on this occasion. So four verses from Galatians 2. Verse 2. "I went up to Jerusalem because of a revelation and set before them," the Jerusalem leaders, "the gospel that I had proclaimed among the Gentiles in order to make sure that I was not running or had not run in vain." So Paul is going to Jerusalem to present to them the gospel that he's preaching, just to make sure it's the same gospel they're preaching. Verse 5, "To them," same Jerusalem leadership, "we did not yield in submission even for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you." So stop right there on that verse. Apparently, if he would have yielded in submission to the Jerusalem leadership, the gospel would not be preserved for you. So the gospel was at stake in his argument with the Jerusalem leadership. Verse 11. "But when Cephas," that's Peter, "when he came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned." There's that word. We don't want to use the word condemned for N.T. Wright. Here was Paul, prepared at least. He didn't notice he didn't make the anathema to Peter. But he said, in some way, he stood condemned. Verse 14. "But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all." So, notice that Paul did not go to Jerusalem to cross his T's and dot his I's. That's not the meaning of the words, "in order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain." Such a rendering would actually contradict the apostle's whole context, beginning in the introduction of that letter and flowing down midway through the second chapter. Namely, that he and his message were independent of the physical Jerusalem church. Rather, Paul means that the Holy Spirit had warned him that his gospel, namely the right one, was being jeopardized by this departure from the gospel happening in Jerusalem. He went to set them straight. Moreover, it was a public showdown in verse 11. And Peter's state of condemnation in verse 11 do not necessarily imply the thought of anathema. No doubt, Paul would have been ready if it had come to that. No doubt, it may have come to that and proven out reprobation for other people involved, people that the scriptures don't mention. But such is not the immediate meaning of condemned or opposed. Consequently, the gospel-preserving task does not avoid some extremes by embracing others. God does not have us choose between gospel preservation and the wrong kind of haughty condemning of others. Paul would not avoid a haughty, divisive messianic complex by calling a departure from the gospel anything less than a departure from the gospel. Paul claimed that Peter's presentation of the gospel was at these points a false gospel. Such a state does not need to encompass a person's whole life in order to be true about a particular case. Imprecision is not the same thing as humility or charity. An understatement about such things empowers the serpents in all of our local vineyards to slither along for another day. Now, whether right is a wolf in sheep's clothing or not is as immaterial to our larger task in the local church as the identity of the other people around Peter from Jerusalem. That is not the basic lesson in the relationship between doctrine and division. That is a confusing distraction. Let's go into why the links between the new perspectives on Paul and N.T. Wright represents, and some of these other theologies. Because one of the things I argued is that this is the dominant new theology in the church. If you can read the writing on the wall, one of the things you can see is that in the next 10 years, Christians who remain Christians, who are in churches that will remain Christian, will either be among this sort of new Calvinist movement or the emergent church. What you see in the missional movement that's sort of hovering in between them, between two opinions, is a trajectory and is a theology that is no different than what the emergent church and the new perspectives are saying at the foundation level. So what are those foundations? Let's talk about the foundations, the structures, and the ends of this new theology just so you can maybe put all these pieces together. It's difficult to say where the center of controversy is between the two parties when one side is characterized by its resistance to having a center. They're against systems with centers or foundations to begin with. The one doctrinal lever on which the wedge seems to be directed is the question over the relationship between soteriology and ecclesiology. So let me erase the board here for a second and show you that this is a battle, really, of whether or not how we're saved determines how we do church, or how we do church or mission winds up being what we mean by being saved. So in the Reformed view, it would sort of flow this way. I draw soteriology flowing down into the circle of, and I'm going to put the word mission, the church's mission. Or is the church on mission encompassing what it means to be saved? So I'll put the gospel in here. I don't even, again, this movement is resistant to a coherent doctrine of salvation, which is what soteriology means. Salvation in the Bible is both reconciliation and restoration. That is, reconciliation with God, restoration back into God's image. And it has to be. If we were made for God, but if we were alienated from Him, then there could be no solution that did not rescue us and make us fit to live unto Himself fully. 1 Peter 3:18 says, "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that He might bring us to God." So salvation is forensic and holistic. So the Reformers would say that, first of all, it's forensic, it's legal, and that's what they think the missional movement in the new perspectives, you know, in other words, there's a legal issue here between God and the sinner. If that's fixed, and it is, by the cross, then He can start to restore us. He can't restore us in His presence and treat us as sons so long as we are traitors. You see that? So it's forensic before it's holistic. It's both, but it's forensic first. That has to be cleared first. So consequently, the traditional doctrine of salvation would not recognize this modern divide. Again, we got that from Kant, and we've talked about that in prior classes. The Reformed, the traditional doctrine of salvation, would never have recognized this divorce between the objective, the legal issue, and the subjective, the moral issue, those dimensions of religion. It's now widely assumed, though, that the Reformed tradition is oblivious to the holistic dimension, that the one goes against the other. The emerging commentator on all things cannot get on in this day without seeing the doctrines of grace as exclusionary to the work of the Spirit. On the other hand, the Reformed will insist that the work of both the Son and the Spirit will inform our doctrine of the Church, for the very good reason that I just covered, that one has to be saved before he or she is a member of the invisible Church. And that means that how God works to reconcile sinners to himself and restore them through the course of life will define what the Church is and how it is to do its business. So maybe we'll write this in a slightly different way. I'll keep everything else on the board. And there's another way to do this. If the question in this circle is, how do we do church? We do church. Or, what is our mission? Well, our mission is going to be completely defined, and what we're to do is completely defined by the message. What is true about what Christ did to reconcile us, and what's true about what the Spirit does to regenerate us and restore us, is going to be absolutely informative to everything in here. You can't even ask that question right without making it about what the message says. And the truth of the matter is that even the emergent church believes that. They just come to different conclusions about how God works than do the Reformed. In other words, your doctrine of salvation, every point, every one of the 5 points of Calvinism, every one of the 5 solas of the Reformation, completely determines how you do church. If you believe that man is seeking after God, and that the only thing standing his way is all those embarrassing Christians, you know, well, what are you going to do in your mission? You're going to try to minimize or hide in the back closet those embarrassing family members, and you're going to give the person increasingly a message that is psychologically conformed to what's palatable to him, what he's already seeking for. So that's just one example of how soteriology always defines ecclesiology, even for those who don't think so. For the Reformed tradition, soteriology explicitly precedes ecclesiology, and that includes missiology. For the emerging movement, missiology engulfs both soteriology and ecclesiology. And the basic reason is that the mission of God, in their view, is a creative act of God from the beginning, and in that sense precedes everything else in what would normally go in a systematic theology textbook. They don't like systematic theology textbooks, but if they wrote one, missiology would be the first section, the mission of God. So you have books with those titles, the mission of God, that are supposed to be those foundational books for them. We have to ask the question of whether or not there is another sense in which salvation precedes mission. That's really the question and the focus we want to get them to. You have to ask, does salvation precede mission? Not God's mission. Of course, God's mission precedes Him saving us, if that's His mission. But we're not God. We're not doing on mission the same thing Christ did when He was sent by the Father. And it is at this point where this becomes a disagreement over Christ Himself. So notice that your doctrine of salvation then will bleed backward into your doctrine of Christ. Jesus told His disciples in John 20:21, "As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." If you start to define that in reverse, the mission of God for me sent by God and Christ, in the same way that Christ was sent by God, you're doing part of the work of Christ. Your doctrine of Christ is now starting to be engulfed in this. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you. This is what we might call a linchpin text for missional theology. And it is exactly here where we find our real point of departure and in which history will show that the missional movement from left to right has fallen for the same error as 19th century liberalism. And I mean even the conservatives. And it's one of the reasons we're no longer in Acts 29. We were sent just as Christ was sent. Is that so? In a total sense? Is there nothing that Christ accomplishes on His mission that we are not to attempt to imitate? The steps to a new Christus exemplar model of the person and the work of Christ are clear. We are not to atone for people's sins. We are not to raise them to newness of life. As someone may object, that we are to live a life that says these things about Jesus that mere words cannot. And we may recall that statement of Francis Assisi, even if it wasn't his statement, to preach the gospel at all times, if necessary, use words. As we will continue to say, this disagreement really reflects the inroads of postmodernism in its suspicion of words. The cover-to-cover focus on narrative is not unique to N.T. Wright either. And it's not unique to these missiologists. One of the things they'll say is that N.T. Wright and these new perspective scholars have restored for us the cover-to-cover, left-to-right biblical theology that Reformed theology, with all of its system-making and its cold logic-chopping, has obscured. Not true. It was precisely the Reformed tradition that had so stressed the unity of the Scriptures, the narrative flow of the Scriptures, which incidentally has a linear, not cyclical, character to it. Biblical history is going somewhere. The story is a system. It's not that there's a story. You got to make your choice. Is the Bible a story or is it a system? That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. Who reads a book in order to forget who Gandalf was by page 5 when you figured out who he was at page 1? Presumably, you want to remember who the characters are. They want to have the same flow with the same meaning. Mordor is that way. The ring does this. And this is why the original guy did that. It's a system. Nobody reads a book to be mindless. All right? So the story is a system where the author is also the architect and artist and his son the hero and his cross the climax and empty tomb the crescendo. And all to the end of the glory of the whole triune God. Let me briefly suggest that in the Reformed tradition, there's always been an understanding between this relationship between biblical or narrative theology and systematic theology. Begin with Augustine's City of God, long before the Reformation. Have you ever read it? It goes from cover to cover in the Scriptures, like a story. Spends an enormous portion of his 23 books unfolding the chronological unfolding of this city in its narrative development. Have you read the Institutes of John Calvin? Yes, he quotes a lot from the Church Fathers. Yes, the book is in the form of a systematic theology of sorts. But he very much goes through methodically the whole Scriptures. It's very difficult to see Calvin's set of commentaries sitting as a whole on your shelf without noticing that this must be one of the biggest exegetical treatments of the text from cover to cover that could possibly be imagined. John Owen wrote his biblical theology in the same way, and Jonathan Edwards' History of Redemption was an attempt to be a biblical theology. So the truth is that there was never a Reformed tradition that was not founded upon a biblical theology prior to the development of its systematic theology. Statements to the contrary in current literature are due to ignorance and sour grapes. Gerhard Voss in the Reformed tradition stated that, quote, the Bible is not a dogmatic handbook but a historical book of dramatic interest. Yet it never occurred to Voss to pit the systematic against the biblical. Each had its design and each was necessary. He said in biblical theology, the principle was one of historical. In systematic theology, it is one of logical construction. Biblical theology, Voss says, draws a line of development from once upon a time to happily ever after. That's what he means by line of development. Systematic theology draws a circle, end quote. In other words, the two are twin brothers from the same parent of truth. Pitting them against each other shows a naivete beneath the task of true theologians. As Waters explains about the contemporary mood, and this is from Waters' book that he criticizes the New Perspectives on Paul, he says, quote, narrative is posed, in other words, in these thinkers, narrative is posed as a pure biblical alternative to what is said to be abstracted systematic formulation. At least two problems attend such a proposal. First, it denies what is an inevitable enterprise. The human mind can no more cease to think systematically than it can cease to think. The question is not whether we will reflect on the biblical narrative systematically, but how we will think on the biblical narrative systematically. Second problem, Waters says, if it is greater theological precision that the interested reader seeks, the methodology is predisposed against it. Now again, I mentioned before in weeks past, anytime you stack John's letters, for example, up against John's gospel for comparison, or his apocalyptic literature, when you say, well, this book has to be read with this in mind and so forth, and you're doing biblical theology, but are you not also doing systematic theology? Why should you read narrative literature this way, a letter this way, and apocalyptic literature this way? Is there any text in Scripture that says, by the way, John wrote three books, and just so you know, it fits into these genres, and Revelation's a lot more like Ezekiel? No, you have to use your noggin for that. That's what we mean by systematic theology. And even Michael Horton, who we'll take issue with for some elements of pietism in his thinking, nevertheless is right to distinguish between the drama of the faith and the grammar of the faith. Doctrine is the second-order language, the grammar, meant in the same way as the grammar stage of classical learning, where we take in the information necessary to the rest of life. But the narrative flow of the text is no worse for wear, because we move from Scripture to system. Every time we close our Bible, hopefully, we'll remember tomorrow what we learned today. So I come up to two texts, John 5:20, for example, and Matthew 24:36. John 5:20, I use this example all the time, it's the first one that comes to my mind. Jesus said that the Father shows him all that he's doing. Matthew 24:36, of that day or hour, no one knows, only the Father, not even the Son. Wait a minute, you said over there in John 5:20 that the Father shows you everything he's doing. Matthew 24:36, there's one thing, at least, that the Son doesn't know. Which is it? But when we remember, hopefully yesterday we didn't forget it, it didn't fall out of our minds when we closed the Bible, that the Son of God is one person, perfectly united to a divine nature and a human nature. And then in Matthew 24:36, his human nature, he really doesn't know that. That wasn't part of the design for the incarnation. He's not lying. He's not concealing something to the disciples. In his human nature, he really does not know that. But in his divine nature, John 5:20, the Father shows him everything he's doing. Okay? So, that's what we're doing. We're doing systematic theology every time we learn, memorize Scripture. That's why we have our kids memorize Scripture, memorizing information that they will apply to other information and synthesize together. It's a good thing. The key is that we never divorce one from the other. The text from the synthesis. We never separate, divorce one from the other. So Horton says, quote, separated from its dramatic narrative, doctrine becomes abstract, like mathematical axioms. However, if we focus only on the Christian story, the tendency of some narrative theologies, we miss crucial implications of that plot and the interconnections between its various sequences, end quote. So, on a popular level, this sort of thinking comes to fruition and demonizes systematic thinking. On a popular level, it's fashionable to object, sometimes you have to put away the driver's manual and get behind the wheel. And this is a reflection of what Kierkegaard said about confessing the faith as opposed to living the faith. Back in the 19th century, the cold Lutheran orthodoxy of his day, what got blamed? Systematic theology. Mere rational reflection versus sacrificial movement. Well, no doubt, one cannot drive effectively while looking down at any piece of literature, driver's manual or otherwise. Yet, wherever one learns to drive, the substance of that skill and awareness of the various traffic infractions are all identical to what is in that manual. Hopefully, when you start driving, you won't forget what the manual said about cows being in the middle of the street in Idaho. I didn't forget that one, I'll tell you that. That was weird. So hopefully you remember what you read when you... So you get the idea. The analogy breaks down like all others, and the objection is of limited application. What matters here is that the current attempt to deconstruct systematic theology with the biblical narrative is driven by a parallel project of these guys of deconstructing inactive individualism. And of course, inactive is just one word with individualism today, because individualism just is inactive. It's inwardly driven. It's self-congratulatory, which reflects a vertical, ethereal reality. And so what do we replace this with today? We replace it with the action-packed narrative that we're all swept up into. So when you hear emerging authors, Federal Vision authors, New Perspectives authors talking like this, whether they even know it or not, they're saying it for that reason and that motive. There's a connection between looking at the story and being in the story. There's a connection. In the real world, there's a connection between looking at the story and being in the story. How good will you be at being in the story with your eyes closed? Yet the new missional theologians insist that we sever the connection and choose either one or the other. Either you'll have your nose stuffed in that driver's manual, or you'll be driving the car without hitting people. I would suggest that if it's a good driver's manual, it will tell you, don't hit people, among other things. The truth of the matter, and this is really the big idea for the whole thing today, what we emphasize in the gospel just is the gospel we preach. What we emphasize in the gospel is the gospel we preach. So see it on that chart on the right. Mission engulfs gospel. Come and be on the mission of God with us. What's the mission of God? Well, he's calling us to be cooperative friends of Jesus to make the world a better place. Boom, that's the gospel they just heard. The emphasis in your gospel just is the gospel that they will hear. Just ask Paul. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, he said, "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. That your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." Now, the thing that Paul was worried about there, namely eloquence to the Corinthians, as far as I can tell, granted I'm not in that culture today, I think I know what the problem is there in history, but I wasn't there. But it seems to me that that's a much more subtle trap, the wisdom and eloquence trap in Corinth, than the missional trap is today. But whatever. In the apostle's mind, the gospel we preach becomes inseparably connected to the force down any rabbit trail we point people to. To the degree that the substitutionary cross for individual sins and righteousness gained is not paramount, the gospel just will be about what the natural center of gravity for the hearer will make of it. When Wright emphasizes the lordship of Christ in the gospel at the expense of justifying individuals, however much he may allow the parallel existence for that justification, so Wright will say things like this: "No, the gospel is about God saving the whole world, restoring the whole of creation, but you can have that stuff about forgiveness of sins thrown in. It's not contradictory with that. You put like cherry on top of a sundae? Like you could have just, like the ice cream wouldn't have melted in hell? Hello?" When Wright emphasizes the lordship of Christ in the gospel at the expense of justification, he is preaching a gospel that was accurately confessed by the demons that ran into Jesus the first time around in Mark 1:24 and Mark 5:7. And hence Piper's response is a perfectly good one. He said, quote, "That Jesus died, rose, and reigns as King of the universe may be terrible news in view of my treason, unless that announcement includes some news about how and why I personally will not be destroyed by the risen Christ," end quote. So, the missional gospel says Jesus is Lord over all creation. He's spreading His justice to the nations. Question: if you're a demon or as bad as one like me, how's that good news? Unless that news includes the way in which Christ has removed your sin and cleansed you and made you righteous. I tell the analogy all the time. Good news, kids. Mom and dad are home. The babysitter analogy. When I say to them, sorry, Josh, I have to tell the story one more time. It's not good news. Okay, so it's the thing that Luther was dealing with in Romans 1:17, is that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. Good news, Luther. God's coming home, and he's mad, and he's taking names. You ever see those bumper stickers? Jesus is coming back, and he's really mad. It's not good news to a demon or a sinner. Okay, so the analogy is this. Leave my kids with the babysitter, Josh and Hannah. Don't watch TV. Be to bed by 8. Don't pick on your sister, etc., etc. As soon as we leave, duct tapes his sister, puts her in the closet, breaks everything, watches all the stuff on TV. Not that he does that, because he doesn't do that. Alright? Half of that stuff. But anyway, so 3 hours later, keys jingling, babysitter turns to them. Good news, kids. Mom and dad are home. What's wrong with that picture? It's not good news. Because they've done all the things we told them not to do. Right? Oh, that's so different. No, it's the same thing. It's the same thing Luther was seeing when he first started to read the Bible in his own language. When he saw Romans 1:17, in the gospel, good news, Luther, righteousness of God's coming home. Luther said, what do I do with that? It's not good news. My righteousness is not just as God's righteousness. Okay, so Piper's statement is exactly right. That Jesus died, rose, and reigns as King of the universe may be terrible news in view of my treason. Unless that announcement includes some news about how and why I personally will not be destroyed by the risen Christ. If that's not the emphasis of your gospel, the good news of why that works, you have no gospel. Now, in times of global communal awareness, we are ever conscious of everybody else's problems. Now, it's human nature to begin with. But it is aggravated in times of social chaos, and the temptations for another gospel just change flavor. According to J. Gresham Machen in Christianity and Liberalism, this is also true about wartime. He said, quote, our attention is called so exclusively to the sins of other people that we are sometimes inclined to forget our own sins. It joins forces, in other words, this natural tendency we have to see other people's sins, it joins forces with the collectivism of the modern state. Machen, where are you going? Are you saying that modern ideologies like socialism aggravate that natural tendency to see other people as the problem? Absolutely. He says, it joins forces with the collectivism of the modern state to obscure the individual, personal character of guilt. End quote. And that is exactly right. Inflating the good in a man gives us the individualism that Wright laments. That's true. But just as much, obscuring the bad in a man can make collectivism look brave and unselfish. What's this have to do with the church? Well, the social self can then rise above the selfish self and think itself less selfish for doing it. So Wright adds in his books, quote, God is rescuing us. He's describing the real gospel. God is rescuing us from the shipwreck of the world, not our own soul rebelling against God, the shipwreck of the world, not so that we can sit back and put our feet up in His company, because remember, that's what justification does. It makes you just sit back and drink your pineapple juice and everybody else is a sinner, not like me. But so that we can be part of His plan to remake the world. Did you hear that? The gospel is God rescuing and then getting us to participate in His plan to remake the world. We are in orbit around God and His purposes. So this is a God-glorifying social gospel, not the other way around, he says. Here's the formula, and it's universal. An individual salvation is man-centered. So, did you hear that? So the old gospel is man-centered because it's not socialism. Oh, they might, they don't know how to say it like that. I did. I'll help them out. An individual salvation is man-centered. A social salvation is God-centered. That is the formula today, and it's catching like wildfire. One more mainstream voice that has picked up on this emphasis is Todd Hunter, former president of Vineyard USA. In his recent book, Christianity Beyond Belief, in 2009, and just the title. Remember Elaine Pagels, she's not part of the Jesus Seminar, but she gets on the Hitler Channel every Easter and tells us how out of the Easter basket at Constantine popped all of what we call Christianity. One of those people. She has a book called Beyond Belief. So when I hear the title said Christianity Beyond Belief, my antennas go up. And Hunter credits Wright for shaping his own gospel subtitles that speak of Jesus as making us, quote, cooperative friends in his kingdom of social justice. So listen to Hunter. He begins his book like this. Our story does not start with us and our need. Okay, good. He's gonna transfer the focus from me to something outside of me, right? Our story does not start with us and our need. It doesn't start with our sin, mistakes, and imperfections and then look forward to heaven. It starts with the perfect intention of God to have a people stop. Sounds like Piper at first. Read the rest of the sentence. Who love him for the sake of others. Ooh! That's clever if your brain kind of turned to simmer by the time you got to that last part of the sentence. Who love him for the sake of others. Not satisfied with pitting our need against God's perfect intention, he continues, quote, first, this is not a story about an angry God who killed his son. If the story is only about sin, heaven, and hell, we can be forgiven for such a misunderstanding. By the way, you need forgiveness for believing in the old gospel. That's the only sin left. But now we know it's a story about God and his kingdom, about a way of life in Jesus. I like that better than the original German. You remember that from 19th century liberalism, right? The common threads in this sort of missional eschatology are obvious enough. 3 points. Number one, a social gospel is bigger. Therefore, it's more God-glorifying. Social gospel bigger than an individual gospel. Therefore, more God-glorifying. Two, a social gospel is selfless. Therefore, less sinful. Third, a social gospel is more effective. The alternative being escapism. I get saved, me and Jesus, and go into heaven to the people, and racism and AIDS and justified. I'm good. Now, bad students of history, the only people that have ever done anything and ever lifted any finger and succeeded to rid the world of injustice are people that believe in the doctrine of justification by faith alone. But I'll leave that aside for now. Now, naturally, proponents of this gospel would prefer that we say cosmic rather than social gospel because if it's easy to identify commonalities with 19th century liberalism. But such logic in those 3 points seems to commit 3 basic mistakes. First of all, it mistakes the size of God's plan for the size of man's span. So, I agree with you, N.T. Wright and Todd Hunter. God is remaking the world. No thanks to you, by the way. And he doesn't need your help. And he does command you to do things in the world. But that's not part of the gospel. You have mistaken the size of God's plan for the size of your own span. Secondly, it mistakes some of the kingdom's effects with the kingdom's actual growth. So they're making the effects of the gospel, which we agree, Wilberforce and the abolition of the slave trade in Britain was no doubt an effect of the gospel, and to that extent, good news. But you've confused an effect of the kingdom with the way it spreads. The kingdom only spreads by gospel preaching. And the Spirit making people alive to that deeper slavery and liberation. Thirdly and finally, it mistakes the temporal orders with the new creation itself. So, what are you fixing? What's God fixing in Romans 8? I don't recall in Romans 8 him saying that he needs these sons of God that he's revealing to do this fixing and revealing of the sons of God and reordering of nature. Oh yes, he's going to do that. But that mistakes the new creation with the old creation. So in short, this is not a guilt by association argument. It is not a slippery slope argument. It is a simple case of common descent. They are all saying the same thing. They are all relying on the same rationale, and they are all aiming at the same goals. It doesn't help that they are patting each other's backs in the process. All right, I had some more stuff to that, but I'll wait for Wednesday. Let me open it up to questions. And we'll wrap up this whole section on the emerging social global gospel. Yo, Josiah, what do you got? Condemned? So it could mean judgment. So you could be condemned to hell, or you can condemn in the sense of criticizing something. So there's sort of a hard condemnation that would be a final judgment, like a judge sentencing someone to die, condemned to die. Or it could be a practical judgment. You're condemning a statement. You're saying that's a you're making an observation. That would be condemning if I believe that. Or that would be condemning to you if I let you go on believing that. And so Paul was doing to Peter in Galatians that second kind of condemning. That's condemning, Peter. This is not in step with the gospel. And you have to make those kind of condemnations to avoid the real bad kind of condemnation. So, Michael?
Yeah, you had mentioned false views just before you stopped, that the social gospel is bigger and therefore more gross, God glorifying.
Yeah.
That it is selfless, and what was the last?
And the third one is the social gospel is more effective. The alternative is escapism. So it's more effective that we would want to ask, at what? Okay, what are we trying to accomplish here? And when they say, well, isn't God going... Yes, God is. God is going to remake creation. Now, when we do things like Wilberforce did, the reason we ought to do it is because of what it says about God, not what it says about us. So when we start to mix up God's new creation with what we are given to do things passionately in the old creation, and that is to reflect the new creation. But that's not the same thing as regenerating souls. The kingdom of God is the souls of the Christians, and that only new souls, new territory only pops up by new souls. New souls only pop up through the seed of gospel preaching. Any other questions or comments or anything? Oh, New Perspectives on Paul, which is largely a skeptical group of scholars. The reason why it's gained all the traction that it has is because of this one guy, N.T. Wright. Because he's more of a churchman. He's like number two in command, so to speak, of the Anglican Church. He's their top scholar that's gotten the most ink in the last 10 years. Prior to that, for 20 years, he was just a... He was a scholar. He's a well-respected biblical scholar. But in the last 10 years, as the new Calvinism has popped up, the devil, as he always does, throws weeds into the wheat, and you have an explosion of young seminary students with no background in classical thinking who are just, ooh, his books are so big, and these books are so small, and his books are so scholarly and aimed at impressing those people to get into the right cocktail parties, and these books are so dogmatic and in the church and stuff like that. And that psychological self-congratulations starts to create in their mind an admiration that is not worthy of admiration. I'm sure he's a nice guy. Now, you can't say anything right about N.T. Wright. I don't know the man. Should Piper be having tea with him? Absolutely. He has that platform. So we're confusing categories here. For me, the issue is not whether or not I'm going to have tea and crumpets with N.T. Wright. The issue is when somebody comes up to me in Boise, Idaho and says, should I read this book? No, it's filth, it's poison. Everything good Wright is saying, and he says a lot of good things about the resurrection of Christ, and so on and so forth, and I can name a bunch of things like that. It's all been said by other scholars already without the heretical ornaments on the tree. Okay, so, oh, isn't that overstatement? I mean, doesn't he have anything to contribute? Well, not if you're contributing that and it's attached to it. It's not a contribution worth getting into.
What's the main scriptural support that the missional tries to use in support of that, the social gospel?
They start with John 20:21, as the Father sent me, I send you. So they start there, that the church that's not on mission, and where they start, they're saying something accurate on a practical level. The church that's not on mission is no church at all. So they're correcting, first of all, they're correcting something, we'll do this in a later chapter, they're correcting something that Western missions had really committed two errors. One, it had tried to convert the heathen to Westernism instead of raising up an indigenous population. But I would say that the error in that is the cultural baggage and not allowing the liberty of the indigenous population to get the truth claims and build them up, indigenous pastors. The problem with that is not things like truth and system being Western and that's what's evil. So right there, there's already an equivocation going on there. The second problem that Western modern missions had done is that it compartmentalized missiology and the work of the missionary to be the dude that we slap on the back, give a couple bucks, and ship them off to Zimbabwe to do all the stuff that we're too gutless to do ourselves. And so what tends to happen, by the way, him being called and us not, that's not the problem. People are called to different things. The problem is that then we don't see the church in Boise as a missionary in our culture. And that affects a lot of our thinking. So that part, the critique part of missional theology, is sound. It's a good thing. But they immediately learn this from post-colonial missiologists, translation, Marxist deconstructionists, who are really using this as an occasion to criticize anything that was ever Western. And so it immediately becomes polluted, but then they start getting into the social thing that, you know, if you read Brian McLaren, you might as well read Brian McLaren because, and it's going to sound like I'm painting with a broad brush here, but he is now where they will be in 10 years. They're kidding themselves.